With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, legislative efforts to provide legal immunity for pesticide manufacturers. We'll have more on that. But to start our day, a demonstration of Ag's future personnel base was on display as part of USDA's 100th Agricultural Outlook Forum. Rod Bain reports.
The kickoff to the recent centennial edition of USDA's Agricultural Outlook Forum featured a poll, one tied to the forum's theme for this year, cultivating the future. Deputy Agriculture Secretary Sochel Torres-Small asked the audience at the starting session,
how many of you are farmers or ranchers? What about processors? Anyone a farm worker or representing farm workers? How many ag researchers do we have in the house? Who's here representing the supply chain? What about bankers or funders? And what about USDA employees?
So what might then the future hold, especially in the minds of those already in the positions mentioned by the deputy secretary and others with ag and food-oriented careers?
If you're farmers, stand up if you don't know who will take over for you when you retire. What about researchers? How about food supply chain people, if you don't know who's going to take over for you?
What was discovered at that session? Some of the several young people in our nation representing the cultivating the future phrase.
Please stand if you consider yourself the future of agriculture.
Between one-third to one-half of the audience at the Ag Outlook Forum morning kickoff session.
Each of you have something that is vitally needed for our future. It only happens when folks who are thinking about the future of their business meet people who are eager to be the future of our business and our food system.
Among those future representatives and leaders of agriculture, 20 students selected from various 1862, 1890, and Hispanic serving land grant universities as part of the Ag Outlook Forum's annual Future Leaders Program. Also gaining valuable experience and perhaps insight into their future, participants in USDA's Next Gen Program. This offering, supported by the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, enables institutions to engage, recruit, retain, train, and support students seeking ag-based careers, including the future workforce of the Agriculture Department. Among next-gen participants, Crystal Salazar of California State University, Monterey Bay.
Through that, I am actually interning with a nonprofit, and I am inspiring and advocating for the youth of my community and inviting them to learn more about agriculture through our career exploration.
Salazar says, as the daughter of field workers and someone who desires a career path in agriculture,
I really hope that one day I can maybe start a foundation or give a scholarship to the children of field workers, because they do very hard work and all these students deserve a chance to be able to come to these wonderful places and have a voice at the table.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
You can now buy a climate smart food product. Here's Gary Crawford with details.
Here is a question for you farmers who may be listening in. Do you think consumers would be willing to pay a little bit more for a food product proven and certified to have been produced in a way that helps the environment, that helps fight climate change, a so-called climate smart product? Well, up to now, there's been no way to answer that question because there haven't been any climate smart products on grocery shelves until now.
It is an extraordinarily important day for American agriculture.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack at a rice packaging facility the other day in Milton, Wisconsin, at a celebration for a milestone in the USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program. That's a USDA program that provides incentives for farmers to adopt climate smart production techniques and practices. It develops ways to accurately measure the results of those practices and develops markets for climate smart products. And Tom Vilsack held up a plastic bag above his head there.
This is the first commercially produced climate smart product. It's a 2-pound bag of rice. It's the first of hundreds of products to respond to consumer demand for sustainably produced food, but also provide an opportunity for farmers to get a better shake in the marketplace.
Now, in the case of rice, it's usually grown in fields that remain flooded during the growing season. Because of that, the crop emits large amounts of methane gas into the air instead of the soil. But under the USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program, farmers were paid to change how they grow rice, only doing very limited flooding of fields.
We've cut our water use by about 50%. We're now using less water than cotton, corn, or soybeans. We're able to lower our fertilizer and maintain or increase yields.
The very essence of the term climate smart. Right now, there are about 140 climate smart projects going on all across the nation.
What that has done is deliver money back to small communities like mine and keep us economically viable. I'm fifth generation, so I believe the climate smart commodity program is going to move agriculture faster than anything we've ever seen.
Producing not only climate-smart commodities, but also, according to the Ag Secretary, Secretary Vilsack, new opportunities for family farmers.
There's an opportunity here for us to expand our income. There's an opportunity for us to be sustainable. There's an opportunity for us to rebuild our rural communities. And that is something certainly to be proud about.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, North Dakota State University could soon be home to a national-level ag policy research institute to complement the work being done at the University of Missouri's Food and Ag Policy Research Institute and the Food and Ag Policy Center at Texas A&M. North Dakota Senator John Hovind secured $2 million in the Senate's fiscal year 2024 agricultural funding bill to establish the new center at NDSU.
For example, one of the areas we want to focus in on is crop insurance. If we make crop insurance better and more cost-effective for the producer, that's a huge and dramatic impact to all of our farmers across the country, not just in North Dakota. So those are the kind of things where we can make a meaningful difference that really helps our producers.
Hovind hosted a roundtable discussion with stakeholders on Tuesday to discuss opportunities for the center in the future.
One of the interesting concepts that came up today is how do we help with all these issues around, you know, pesticides and those kind of things? Because, you know, we've got to be able to apply fertilizer and pesticides to crops. At the same time, there's a lot of pushback from a lot of different areas from folks that really don't understand agriculture, you know, and so that's a whole other area where we can have a big and a meaningful impact. One of the other areas that's been talked about is having a role in dairy. I think that's one where we might find a relationship on something like that. But clearly some good ideas where we can have a big impact when you're talking crop insurance, you're talking risk management for livestock, you're talking about how we get work ahead on the curve with inputs and pesticides so our farmers can continue to do what they need to do to raise their crops.
In some policy areas like dairy, the NDSU Center would potentially collaborate with experts from other institutions, such as the University of Wisconsin or Michigan State University.
With the Policy Center, it won't all be done here. Part of it is pulling in partners because that always creates more opportunities for us. And so you'll see that. Dairy might be an example.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with the Livestock Report.
In today's livestock news, a recent USDA study looks at potential stocking impacts and financial climate risks within its Livestock Forage Disaster Program. Rod Bain reports.
Drought conditions could lead cattle producers to make decisions regarding the stocking numbers or liquidation of their herds. Yet, how does USDA's Livestock Forage Disaster Program mitigate those decisions?
The Livestock Forage Disaster Program, which is administered by USDA's Farm Service Agency, aims to alleviate some of these financial pressures by offering financial compensation to livestock producers that are impacted by drought. Drought conditions are defined by the U.S. Drought Monitor.
Aaron Rosenzik of the Agriculture Department's Economic Research Service is among a group of researchers taking a closer look at LFP.
We at ERS were interested at looking at the impact of this program because the Farm Service Agency has spent about $12 billion in 2022 dollars between 2008 and 2022 on this program. So it was a question to us, how is this program influencing livestock producers' stocking and herd retention decisions?
Among the findings within the recently released ERS study,
counties that were eligible for LFP payments behaved similarly in terms of their livestock herd retention and stocking making decisions as those that were less affected by drought and eligible for payments. To us, that's saying that the program is encouraging some herd retention when producers are faced by drought.
Research was also detailed into the connection between federal expenses with the Livestock Forage Disaster Program and mitigating greenhouse gases.
We find that the Livestock Forage Disaster Program can potentially constitute a financial climate risk for the federal government in the future. What we found is that by the 2070 to 2100 time period, annual aggregate average LFP payments may increase by more than 100% in 2022 dollars than the average between 2014 and 2022.
Then there was investigation into how the very definition of drought, if changed over time due to changing climatic conditions, could alter the current financial climate risk model of LFP.
What we also found is that how drought is classified is really important for this financial climate risk of the program. So if how drought's classified, it changes over time or evolves to reflect changing climatic patterns, then the program constitutes a much smaller financial climate risk for the federal government.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
In other livestock news, the American Lamb Checkoff Program has substantially increased the value of American lamb despite the modest funding available for promotion, according to Texas A&M University's 2024 report, Return on Investment in the American Lamb Checkoff Program, conducted by agricultural economists Dr. Gary Williams and Dr. Oral Capps. According to the study, lamb consumption increased from $1.17 billion to $1.31 billion. Researchers attributed to the increase to ALB's promotional efforts, which increased both lamb consumption rates and retail lamb prices. This lift resulted in an average annual growth of between $58.7 million and $62.4 million. The purpose of the lamb checkoff has been to increase demand for American lamb, says ALB Chairman Jeff Ebert. The results of this study confirm that despite a small budget, ALB's promotional efforts have successfully resulted in increased demand for lamb. The study showed $100 generated in revenue for every 4.3 cents invested in lamb promotion. I'm Will Jordan for Agnet West.
Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or just need to catch the news at a different time, you can subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search for the Agnet News Hour on your favorite podcast downloading app. This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's Agnet West headlines, here's Agnet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
California was well represented on the recent trade mission to South Korea. Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs, Alexis Taylor, explained the market opportunities for California's specialty crops.
I think we are able to really expand in the showcase of what we can provide and what we can export and how that can really benefit Korean consumers. So from a California perspective, we had several California fresh fruit sectors represented, some of the tree nuts represented. And so while we have exports there, I think we are also looking to continue to grow and expand those. We're working on expanded market access, for instance, of nectarines. And so the Tree Fruit Association was there, obviously because they have some interest in already exporting, but looking towards potentially new market access for California nectarines. And so I think when we go into these markets, it is what we're currently exporting, but also looking for new market opportunities. Again, so important to the diversification work that we're doing as we think about how do we diversify revenue streams, making sure we've got new markets for new products or open markets for existing products to expand into is really important.
Various legislative efforts are underway to provide legal immunity to pesticide manufacturers. Supported by major agribusinesses, a bill proposed in Iowa aims to shield manufacturers from lawsuits related to insufficient warnings regarding the health risks of glyphosate-based products. A proposal to exempt pesticide distributors, dealers, and applicators from product liability claims is also moving through the legislature in Florida. Similar legislative debates are also occurring in Missouri, along with Idaho, where proposed laws have generated significant controversy. While critics contend that granting immunity may impede transparency and public health protections, supporters of the legislative efforts argue that the bills would provide necessary legal protections for pesticide manufacturers.
Proponents assert that such protections are crucial for maintaining the integrity of the regulatory process and ensuring compliance with existing EPA labeling requirements. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's unveiled a significant investment of $124 million in renewable energy and fertilizer production projects across 44 states. The initiatives aim to reduce energy costs, generate income, and create jobs for farmers and ranchers and rural businesses. Over $120 million is allocated to 541 Renewable Energy for America program projects, promoting wind, solar, and clean energy sources. Additionally, the Fertilizer Production Expansion Program receives over $174 million to support 42 projects nationwide. USDA's efforts have already directed over $1.8 billion into REAP projects, fostering renewable energy and energy efficiency improvements. Applications for REAP funding are ongoing until September 30th, with a focus on underutilized renewable energy technologies. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service is enhancing animal health preparedness through a $1 million collaboration with the National Animal Health Laboratory Network. The funding facilitates swift investigations of unexplained morbidity and mortality events in animals, which could indicate emerging threats. Managed by Michigan State University's Veterinary Diagnostic Laboratory, the agreement reimburses testing expenses at any non-laboratory for UME cases meeting specific criteria. APHIS aims to detect potential disease threats early through advanced testing and collaboration with NALM. APHIS emphasizes the importance of early detection in protecting animal, food, and potentially human health, as well as international trade. The initiative contributes to safeguarding the U.S. meat industry by preserving market access and preventing foreign animal diseases. Six farm workers were recently celebrated for their dedication and service to the community on National Ag Day last month. Anna Genasi from the Stanislaus County Farm Bureau highlighted the individuals honored at their annual Farm Worker of the Year Awards, made possible through a partnership with AgSafe and the Modesto Rotary Club.
Our winner, and I even hate to use that word because they all have really great stories, but the one that stood out, I guess, was Salvador Anya with Stuart and Jasper. He has worked for S&J for 55 years. He started in high school as a laborer picking up pruning brush. And now he's leading crews. He's doing all of the irrigation work. And I do want to make sure, though, that we give a shout out to the other folks that were recognized. While Salvador was our platinum winner, Ishmael Garcia with Heinrich Farms, who's been with them for decades, has become their right-hand man. And then in third place was German Partida. He's with a dairy. His story, you know, has grown in responsibilities, has been with the family farm for decades. And then our honorable mention group was Nathan White with Serpa Farming, Antonio Machuca with Rod Gambini Farming, and then Keaton Machado with Machado Farms. And so all these folks work here in Stanislaus County for agricultural employers.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Want to join the National Mushroom Council? Now's your chance. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The USDA is looking for nominations for the Mushroom Council to fill three seats with terms expiring on December 1st of 2027, and one seat whose term will expire on December 31st of 2025. Nominees may seek nomination to the council for all the open seats that they're eligible for. Applications are available now at mushroomcouncil.com. The 9-member council includes 8 producer members and 1 importer member. More information is available on the Mushroom Council website on the AMS website. The Agricultural Marketing Service policy is that the diversity of the boards, councils, and committees it oversees should reflect the diversity of its industries in terms of the experience of members, methods of production and distribution, marketing strategies, and other distinguishing factors. Throughout the full nomination process, the industry must conduct extensive outreach, paying particular attention to reaching underserved communities and considering the diversity of the population served. Welcome back. Here's Chuck Zimmerman.
I'm visiting with Janae Brady, and we are here at the ASTA booth at Commodity Classic. First of all, Janae, what do you do?
I'm the VP of Government Affairs for the American Seed Trade Association.
Great. So I want to talk about, it's a survey that ASTA did on climate smart commodities and the number of acres. And tell me a little bit about this survey that you did.
Yeah, so over the last few years, as we've looked at programs that USDA is rolling out, specifically the climate Smart Ag or Climate Smart Commodity Program, we've been paying close attention to the practice of cover crops in particular and what that means for the seed industry and our ability to meet what is clearly a growing demand. So with that in mind, as USDA's work to get these grants up and running, ASTA led a survey to get a better understanding of exactly what that demand looks like. And largely the results are that over the course of the 5 years of these grants, we're expected to see over 10 million acres of increased cover crop acreage.
Over what period of time?
Over the 5 year period of the grants, yeah.
And at that point, what happens?
Well, you mean at the end of the 5 years? Or we're really looking at what happens right now as we're getting ready to encounter those grants and the acreage that results from it. I think what happens after is a good part of that question, though. Do the farmers have success with cover crops? Are they able to continue that adoption or continue the utilization of it? And that's something that we're going to have to continue to keep an eye on. But right now, we're really just trying to get a good understanding for what is in front of us and ensuring that our members are prepared and able to produce the seed that's needed. And we're confident that they can do so.
Do you assist them in applying or whatever?
We did not participate in the application process, but we have many different members who are involved in the grants in various levels. Some are direct awardees, some are partners, supporting partners, things like that. The other piece that we have been doing a lot of work on is outreach with awardees that aren't necessarily members but are absolutely going to need high-quality, professionally produced seed. So we have a tool, a resource on our website that allows farmers to be able to go and look up their region and find conservation seed dealers in that area. So trying to help connect the dots between seed dealers and distributors and their customers.
Anything else about this particular survey that you'd like people to know we didn't touch on?
You know, I think the main message that I think that we knew before the survey, but that the survey really told us, is that as you look at sustainability practices and the big challenge that producers have in endeavoring sustainable practices and resiliency in the land, is that seed is a really important part of that solution. And we're excited to be a part of that. We're excited to make sure that we're producing exactly what farmers need to be able to meet those needs and to help the environment in the long term.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Janae, for visiting with me here. We're at Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
USDA recently issued a report looking at how global production of agricultural products has grown and developed over a six-year period, including in the realm of sustainability. Rod Bain reports.
The Agriculture Department's Economic Research Service recently crunched data to get a better idea of how global agricultural production has transformed over a six-decade period since 1961. Among those overseeing this study and reporting on its findings, USDA economic researcher Keith Fugley.
What this report tries to do is look at broad trends in global agricultural production, resource use, and productivity, how productive those resources employed in agriculture have been.
The report not only looks at productivity, but how ag on a world scale has impacted long-term sustainability from 1961 to 2020. First, from the productivity side.
From 1961 all the way up to 2020, global agricultural output increased by about fourfold.
With gross value growing from $1.1 trillion, with a T, dollars at the start of the study period to $4.3 trillion by 2020. Also changed over that same time period, increased diversity of products.
So some of the traditional things like root and tuber crops, cereal grains, they're actually a smaller share of that total output today than they were in prior decades. What has grown are oil seeds, fruits and vegetables, non-ruminant livestock like poultry and pork, and then especially we've seen huge growth in farm-raised fish, or what we call aquaculture.
Land in global agriculture grew 8% during that six-decade time frame. But what Fugley found interesting was the primary location of this growth.
The location of where that output is coming from has really shifted from what we call in the report the global north. That's kind of the high-income countries of North America, Europe, and then Asia Pacific, like Japan, and Australia, and it's shifted to the global south, Latin America, Africa, and the rest of Asia.
Irrigated area grew by over two times between 1961 and 2020.
It uses about two-thirds of the world's surface area. Irrigation uses about 70% of the world's freshwater resources.
As far as resource use goes,
agriculture has become more productive. It's reducing the use of those resources around the world. So we're getting a lot more output per unit of land as well as per unit of labor, but also getting more efficient use of fertilizers. We're reducing the amount of resource of water per output as well as greenhouse gas emissions per output.
For instance, the amount of labor dedicated to agriculture peaked at over 1 billion people in 2003. By 2020, that total labor force for ag around the world had declined to 840 million people. Meanwhile, the input of feed concentrates made from protein-dense oilseeds and crops has increasingly become an important source of livestock, poultry, and farm-raised fish nutrition over the six-decade period. To get a better idea of the balance between agricultural productivity and sustainability worldwide between 1961 and 2020, the report used a measure known as total factor productivity, a term you might have heard before, as it is the basis of Virginia Tech University's annual Global Agricultural Production Report. In essence, it measures what is produced commodity-wise versus the amount of basic inputs used to raise such product. Keith Fugley explains.
Today, most of the world is on a real TFP growth path where it's new technologies, better farming methods that are raising output and not just bringing in more stuff to produce that output. Now, that's not true everywhere in the world. Africa, for example, lags behind in shifting from sort of what we call resource-dependent growth to productivity-led growth. But the world as a whole now is getting more than two-thirds of its growth from just raising productivity rather than expanding resource utilization.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. For today's featured interview, I'm talking with USDA Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger. All right, we wanted to talk about a crop insurance option for nurseries. And this is really important to a lot of my listeners because we have a lot of, I have a lot of specialty crop listeners, and that includes a lot of nurseries. So tell me a little bit about this. I know it's been available in some states, but it's going to be expanding?
That's correct. We are expanding into five times as many states as we have been before. And so we are very proud, excited that we are being able to expand. It's going to be built upon a previous nursery program that's been around for I think like almost 30 years. The holder of that policy is a family-run business, and they're retiring, and they're not interested in continuing on. So we've taken over, what that policy looks like, but then we've added some good enhancements to it.
Can you tell us what some of those enhancements are?
We've simplified the application and annual policy renewal process. We're allowing nursery producers to select the dollar amount of coverage that best fits their risk management needs. We're allowing coverage to be tailored to an individual practice, whether it be container or field grown. In the instance of buy-up policies, you can choose from any of the 10 potential plant categories. We've simplified the loss adjustment process. We've eliminated a plant list that was using a third-party software, and so there's greater reliance on the producer's inventory records. And I think we are also making changes to program dates that are better suited to the producer's agronomy, their needs in their, more specific to their own individual operations. And then we've also added a new occurrence loss option. So we're moving the deductible from a unit level to a plant level. So those are just, I think, some of the improvements that we've made to the existing policy, which are quite a few, actually.
Yeah. And so those improvements obviously will be for people who already hold policies as well as people who will now have the access to them, right?
That is correct. Yes.
What were some of the, I think it was 9 states that was currently available. Do you know offhand what states those were? And I know I'm putting you on the spot here.
Sure. Prior to the expansion, it was available in select counties in Alabama, Colorado, Florida, Michigan, New Jersey, Oregon, Tennessee, Texas, and Washington. And now Nursery Value Select will be available in all counties in all states. And that will start for the 2025 crop year. So not this coming year, but next year.
So that's going to be really big for our California listeners who have not had access to this. For those who haven't had access and don't know a whole lot about it, how would you explain it to them?
You know, I would probably go back to the talking points that I just mentioned as far as how we've expanded it. But I would also encourage listeners, those interested in seeing if they can't schedule some time to listen to the online workshops that we're going to be providing. So we'll have subject matter experts online to present the information, but then also have an opportunity for listeners to send in questions so that they can get answers to their specific questions. And those workshops are scheduled coming up fairly soon in April. We have 2 in April at different times on the same day. So April 18th, one is at 1 p.m. Central Time, and the other one is at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. So like you're saying, your Californians that haven't had an opportunity to have this program can now tune in and get firsthand information from RMA subject matter experts. And if you can't make the April 18th date, we're also holding another online workshop on July 18th at 2 p.m. Central Time. So I would encourage people to maybe go to our RMA website at www.rma.usda.gov and read the fact sheet, the information that we have posted there, but also hopefully pencil in some time to listen to those workshops.
I really love that they're going to be interactive. This isn't something that you just sit and watch. If you actually have questions, you will be able to get your questions answered.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, and we kind of just started doing more of this type of interactive learning in the last couple of years. And it started out with the whole farm policy concept. 2 years ago, we did a whole farm roadshow that we did both virtually and in person. And then this past year, we did a livestock roadshow, both virtually and in person, because Nursery Value Select is pretty specific to areas that have climate that's more conducive to these types of operations. We are going with all virtual. And so I think that will also allow us to record the session so that if somebody can't attend the live events, that they can go back and then listen. And I would always encourage people that always at your access are our regional offices in your specific areas that we have RMA subject matter experts available that, you know, as you go along in the season and you have a question and you think, oh, you know, that wasn't covered, to reach out to our regional offices and to talk to a live person to assist with getting some answers for you.
That's fantastic because there's just no replacing that live person too, right?
That's right. That's right. And it also is an opportunity, I think, and we welcome the feedback. So this will be a pilot and there's always room for improvement. So as the holder of the policy experiences it, we welcome what that experience looked like. And, you know, to not only say, you know, this part really worked well, but this was some of the challenges I saw, that you provide that feedback so that we can continue to improve the product.
So because it can be hard to retain some of this information that you're just hearing on the radio, where can they go online and get more information about these online service meetings?
Sure. So go to www.rma.usda and type in the search bar Nursery Value Select, and it'll pull up, I think, a number of different articles, information, bullet points, along with the upcoming seminars that we're holding online.
Thank you again to USDA Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. Now for more news. It's not just the name of what was previously known as the U.S. Spring Flood Outlook that is different about 2024's forecast of potential flood events this season. Rod Bain explains.
Once called the Spring Flood Outlook, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration removed the word flood from its weather outlook for the season. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for spring 2024, that is appropriate. In that,
we are not expecting any significant spring flooding across the northern plains or the upper Midwest, a big departure from what we normally see in these outlooks.
As a combination of antecedent drought the past 3 years and below average snowfall over the winter is expected to result in no flooding in that region. In other parts of the country,
there are very few areas expecting any moderate flooding, and nowhere in the United States expecting major spring river flooding. Those pockets of potential moderate flooding mostly focused across the Mid-South and then in just a few areas in the Southeast.
In fact,
the only areas where we even expect some minor flooding possible is roughly from the eastern plains, eastern Kansas, eastern Oklahoma, and eastern Texas, extending eastward through the Mid-South, the Ohio Valley, the Tennessee Valley, and right to the Atlantic coast from southeastern Virginia southward through Georgia. We can exclude Florida's peninsula from this spring flood concern.
One minor flood risk area this spring, some watersheds in the Great Basin extending into southeastern Idaho.
A pretty benign spring flood outlook, given that antecedent drought from 2020 through 2023, as recovery from that continues, and then the relatively dry winter and snowless winter in some of the key watershed areas of the upper Mississippi Valley.
And that, Rippey says, lends itself potentially to
having a third consecutive year of low river flows, especially late summer into autumn, in parts of the Missouri, Mississippi, and Ohio valleys. That's a little bit too early to get a real good handle on, but given some of these antecedent conditions, drought in the upper Midwest and long-term drought looking further back, there is at least some risk that we could see low flows in some of our key watershed areas of the Mississippi and extending into the navigable waters of the middle and lower Mississippi Valley and the lower Ohio Valley. That many producers depend on moving fertilizer shipments north and grain and oilseed crops south as we get to the autumn and into the early part of the winter. So something to keep an eye on.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A new case of bird flu transmission means producers may want to pull out that PPE. David Geiger has this report.
A human case of highly pathogenic avian influenza was found in Texas. The virus has been rampant over the last decade, but has stayed mostly bird to bird. This past week, a case was found in a dairy cow, causing concerns of a new form of spread. While she thinks it's good to be cautious, Renee Anthony, the center director with the Great Plains Center for Agricultural Health, says there was a case in 2022 of a transmission from bird to human.
That hasn't happened since. So finding out what's going on in Texas, it's gone from bird to cattle to human. And so we're a little bit more concerned than we have been in the past. There may be, you know, a limited isolated case happening in Texas, but we really need to be prepared for the next step.
The Center for Disease Control and Prevention says to avoid diseased or dead animals. Anthony says if a farmer can't do that,
sorry, guys, put back on some respiratory protection and do some hand washing. So we're really looking at more than just wearing those cloth masks that we used before. We're really looking at wearing these, you know, N95s, if we can get our hands on those when we're working around sick cattle. The less we are breathing in air that may be contaminated with the virus, the lower our chance of inhaling that virus and having a mutated form that's going to affect us.
The Great Plains Center for Agricultural Health has avian influenza resources for producers, including best practices and good protective equipment recommendations, which can be found on its website. I'm David Geiger reporting.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.